Army Times analysis found a high rate of suicide among armor brigades. Produced by Defense News and Military Times, this is the Early Bird Brief. Each morning, we bring you the defense and national security news of the day. We talked with Army Times senior reporter Davis Winkie to hear more about the startling findings and what they say about the Army's suicide prevention programs. I'm your host, Jonathan Lehrfeld. Today is Monday, March 11th, 2024. Just a heads up to listeners that this story discusses the topic of suicide. If you or a loved one are experiencing thoughts of self-harm or suicide, you can seek assistance by calling 988 and dialing 1. You can also text 838-255 or chat online at veteranscrisisline.net. Hey, Davis, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be back.
So I want to jump right into it. What can you tell us about some of the numbers you uncovered in regard to deaths by suicide for tankers between 2019 and 2021?
So after a long process where we constructed a database of deaths in the Army over a three-year period, we found that enlisted tankers who hold the 19-kilo MOS had the highest suicide rate of any large population career field during that three-year window. We also found that members of armored brigade combat teams, regardless of what career field they held, were more than twice as likely to die by suicide than other soldiers in the active duty Army. Interestingly, this data trend held up across all of the Army's 11 active duty armored brigade combat teams. While some brigades were worse than others, every single one of them during that three-year period experienced a suicide rate that was higher than the Army-wide average. And that led us to start asking questions about what's impacting all of these units independently of, say, what installation they're at or what local leadership they have. We started asking bigger questions after seeing those numbers.
So let's take a step back for a moment. Can you briefly give us a quick synopsis of your story and then also explain to listeners the process that went into telling it?
Once we had realized these alarming preliminary findings from our data set, we set to finding out, okay, why? We consulted with suicide prevention experts. We consulted with retired senior leaders, including General Robert Abe Abrams, who's a career armor officer whose father is the namesake for the tank that these units ride into battle. And we talked to these people and asked, what is going on in the armor community? Why might we be seeing these elevated suicide rates? And what the mental health experts told us was that new lines of mental health research indicate that a person's daily stress and hassles can increase their suicide risk by making them less resilient to, say, major stressors that could arise, like the end of a relationship. Armored brigades, we learned from Abrams and others, have these stressors in spades day to day. They are some of the most deployed units in the Army and have been so for a decade. They have very, very high maintenance demands that lead to long working hours. And these soldiers, Jonathan, they're tired. And once we understood ways that their risks might be increased, we started to dig further into the data and find places where this might have been worse than others. And that's how we settled on the story of 1st Battalion 66th Armor Regiment, the Iron Knight Battalion. It's the Army's oldest tank battalion. It's at Fort Carson, Colorado. And during a 14-month span, this unit suffered 6 suicides.
So can you tell us more about who the Army tankers are? You know, what's their mission and how many soldiers are there across these brigades?
As a lot of our listeners know, the Army's main piece on the strategic chess board in recent decades, so to speak, has been brigade combat teams. These are units of between 4,000 and 4,700, depending on which type, units of 4,000 to 4,600 soldiers that are designed to be able to deploy overseas and carry out combat operations while remaining self-sustaining. It's the smallest unit that can provide for itself and be a standalone entity on the battlefield. That's the idea behind the BCT. One of the types of BCTs, the Armored Brigade Combat Team, has been in exceptionally high demand over the past decade. The reasons for that are complex, but ultimately they boil down to this. Their supply overseas has decreased with the closure of overseas bases in the early 2010s, and the demand for them increased during that period because of the closures. Essentially, the Army and Pentagon began rotating armored brigades to the places where they previously had them permanently based. And the idea underpinning these non-combat rotations is that they provide credible combat capability in a theater that then deters enemy actors from further aggression. The idea behind having a tank brigade in Korea, which the Army did on a rotational basis from 2013 to 2021, is that the North Koreans will know that there is a deadly, lethal army formation on that peninsula that is going to stand in their way in case they try anything. For the soldiers in these units, the tankers, the infantrymen, and the Bradley companies, the maintainers, this demand in daily life meant that they had to start spending more time in the field, more time in the motor pool, and ultimately more time overseas. Most of these brigades in over the past decades have been deploying every 18 months or so. They'll complete a 9-month mission overseas. That provides what's called a 2-to-1 dwell to deployment ratio, where units spend 2 months at home for every 1 month overseas. And experts say that isn't a lot of time to get these units ready, and is contributing to the stress and strain that the soldiers are experiencing.
I want to make sure we're talking about some of the real people behind these numbers that you shared. Can you tell us a little bit more about Sergeant Cody Kane and Specialist Wyatt Tifo?
Yeah, Jonathan, these guys were soldiers assigned to 1st Battalion 66 Armor. They died by suicide during the winter of 2020, which was a really dark time for this unit. The unit experienced a rash of suicides back-to-back, and Kane and Tifo were two of the ones that hit their colleagues really hard. Cody Kane was a 24-year-old infantryman and father. He died on November 11, 2020, when he killed himself in his Fountain, Colorado home. Kane grew up in Arkansas. I spoke with his mother, and she told me a story about how dedicated he was to the Army and to his fellow soldiers. He completed basic training with a fractured hip, hiding the injury, because he didn't want to let his buddies down and he wanted to graduate alongside them. So this was the kind of man that Cody Kane saw himself as being. And the others in the unit told me that Kane was just a social butterfly, somebody who really connected with a lot of the younger soldiers. And his death hit his company and the battalion very hard, especially because it came less than a week after another beloved NCO from the battalion's Bradley Company had died in a really violent car accident outside the installation gates. Less than 2 weeks after Kane's death, Specialist Wyatt Tifo, who was a medic assigned to Battle Company 166, died in what was ultimately ruled a suicide at a party at a fellow soldier's apartment. Tifo was 20 years old when he died. He was somebody who was seen as having a really bright future in the Army. He was very bright. He'd scored well on his entry tests. He could have done anything, a lot of his colleagues thought. He could have been a fantastic medic, or maybe he might try to go special ops, or he might get out, go to college, and make a life outside of the Army. He'd been a accomplished wrestler in high school. He qualified for state his senior year with a 38-12 record. I spoke with his mother about his upbringing, and she said that his senior season of high school wrestling and then his experiences early in his Army career were really a dream came true. She has actually struggled to accept his death as a suicide. She believes that it may have been an accident. Forensically speaking, it's pretty well established that the injuries that killed Tifo were self-inflicted. She believes that he may not have meant to do them. And that really goes to show the lingering pain that something like this can have on a family. Tifo's death also really impacted the soldiers around him, other Iron Knights told me. One of them, his squad leader and a fellow medic, told me that back-to-back deaths of Kane and Tifo really left him in a dark place, experiencing intense survivor's guilt, because he felt responsibility for the two of them. Their stories really show the multiple layers and ripple effects that these tragedies can have.
Yeah, I want to follow up on a point that you just made, which is that in addition to the families and loved ones of those lost, I imagine, of course, that these suicides have a really heavy impact on the soldiers as well, who have to keep going. So what can you tell us about what you learned from that?
While reporting this story, I spoke with more than 60 soldiers assigned to various brigade combat teams. About 20 of them were current or former members of the Iron Knight Battalion. All of these guys and gals had experienced suicides in their units and told me about the way it really detracted from their morale, detracted from their cohesion. And in some cases, it can actually reduce a unit's combat readiness. One soldier told me that the soldiers who were in the Iron Knight Battalion, for example, have experienced a higher rate of mental health issues that have impacted their ability to medically deploy since experiencing the suicides that occurred in 2020 and 2021. So like, not only does this devastate people on a personal level and run the risk of creating moral injury, run the risk of creating survivor's guilt, PTSD, other things that may contribute to further individual suicides, there's also that impact on whether this is making the armored brigades less effective by either making them less medically ready, as we discussed, or potentially driving some experienced soldiers to leave the Army, to get away from that kind of environment.
So let's get to one of the cruxes of what I think your article gets at, which is, why are armor units so busy? And how is that impacting them? And what have some suggested to manage that?
Understanding the roots of this crisis of op tempo or operational tempo, basically how much time a soldier or unit spends away from home for training or deployments, loosely defined. The roots of this op tempo crisis require a little bit of a history lesson. Earlier, I mentioned the closure of overseas bases that brought home armored brigades that were previously forward stationed in Germany and in Korea. Those locations almost immediately then became places where armor brigades who were based in the US then had to start deploying to on a standing basis. And it turned into this treadmill where, in order to maintain units in Europe, units in Korea, and units in the Middle East, where they're mostly just sitting in Kuwait as a theater armor reserve, you had these guys just working like crazy to go overseas one after the other. What exacerbated this was strict manning requirements called business rules that the theater combatant commanders, so Pentagon level commanders, would set for armored brigades, even for non-combat deployments. These requirements would be, you know, like you've got to have a certain proportion of your manpower. You need to have your vehicles at a certain readiness. You need to be trained to a certain standard. These standards make sense in order to ensure that the units are equal when they come in as rotational units. But they also result in hardship at home, where division commanders and others would have to pull soldiers from other brigades to make brigades meet the manning requirements, for example, before going overseas. And doing that breaks up tank crews, it breaks up command teams, it detracts from cohesion. As the time that these units were able to spend at home in between these deployments got shorter, eventually settling at about 18 months as the typical timeline, that's not a lot of time to check all your pre-deployment boxes. An armored brigade combat team to qualify to deploy, they need to go to the National Training Center or to the Joint Readiness Training Center. They need to do a combat training center rotation. And to do a CTC rotation, you need to pass brigade level training at home. And to pass brigade level training, you have to pass battalion level training. To pass battalion level training, you've got to pass company level training. To do that, you've got to have qualified crews who do gunnery well. And you've got to have platoon level live fire training. For tanks and tank units and with their Bradleys, getting to the field is no small task, especially if you're having trouble keeping the vehicles running because of endemic parts backlogs. And the stress level just kept building over time for many of these units as they felt like they never had a break. They would get home, they would take their post-deployment leave, and then launch straight into the cycle to go overseas again.
How did COVID impact all of that?
For units that were already overseas, COVID meant your deployment was going to be longer. For units that were preparing to go overseas, COVID took time out of your training calendar, but it did not change the boxes that you needed to check before you go. So in the case of 1st Battalion 66 Armor, which is part of the 3rd Armored Brigade Combat Team of the 4th Infantry Division at Fort Carson, that meant they had to check all their boxes even faster. And that led to a compressed and very intense training cycle where these guys spent even less time at home than usual during their train up for the National Training Center and then later on before their next deployment. That really, really impacted those guys' lives.
What can you tell us about the Army's existing suicide prevention programs? Are there other programs that also exist? And has the Army said anything specifically about these findings on the armor brigades?
Yeah, I'll start with the last part first. The Army's data experts confirmed the general accuracy of our findings. They confirmed that tankers experienced the highest suicide rate of any major field during that time period. They also confirmed that armored brigades were at a higher suicide risk than the rest of the force. We've got more details on the numbers available in a methodology explainer that we can find, that readers can find on the website. When it comes to the service's suicide prevention program, though, it hasn't caught up yet to the idea of systemic suicide risk for populations across the board. Army suicide prevention is really tuned toward the individual and small unit level. With the goal being identifying soldiers who need mental health treatment, ensuring they have access to those resources, ensuring they have access to other support resources that can help alleviate acute stressors such as financial difficulty. Army suicide prevention also is managed pretty heavily at the installation level, where, say, Fort Carson, The commanding general there will oversee garrison-level resources that are meant to serve all of the units there and do data analysis based on the installation level. But what we learned while reporting this story was that the Army really hasn't conceived of systemic suicide risk affecting armor brigades in this way. When they checked our math on armor brigade suicide rates, they actually had to create a field for that in their database because it wasn't programmed to look for it. And even though they claimed that they were aware of this phenomenon, it wasn't until spring of last year that the Army requested a research study on the link between armor units' operational tempo and their suicide rates, which, by the way, no research partner has started work on. So the Army is still in the discovery phase when it comes to understanding this problem of systemic suicide risk impacting the armor community. However, there are a handful of efforts outside of the suicide prevention program that show some promise for alleviating the difficulties we've spoken of. At Fort Cavazos, they've established new pre-company command training and pre-battalion executive officer training that includes modules really devoted to making sure that these leaders know how to run an armor unit's maintenance program without running the soldiers into the ground. Because if leaders run their maintenance programs poorly, that is one of the things that can have a massive impact on soldier work hours and baseline stress levels while they're in garrison. When it comes to reducing operational tempo, the Army has tried to reduce the amount of overseas deployments, but a spokesperson told me that overseas basing, which could potentially solve this problem for good, revisiting that would be really complex. It would require diplomatic approvals. It would require Congress. It would require host countries to come to the table. Meanwhile, the Iron Knight Battalion is about to deploy again on barely 15, 16 months dwell time. The treadmill continues for these guys.
Why did the Iron Knights choose to speak out about the suicides?
Yeah, so tomorrow morning, readers will be able to find a third story in this project going up on our site where the 8 current or former Iron Knights who chose to speak under their names for the story explain why they did it. More or less, those who chose to speak to me and take the risk of speaking under their names did so out of loyalty to each other. They did so out of a sense of obligation to the dead. And they also did so because they don't know whether Army leaders fully understand the problems that they've faced. They are just desperate to be heard and to have people understand what happened to them. They want people to take seriously the ways in which these problems might be addressed before another battalion goes through what the Iron Knights did.
Okay, let's talk more about the data. Can you briefly talk about that for us? Again, what went into researching the findings and where, if at all, does the data fall short?
Yeah, this reporting process started for us in the summer of 2022 when we started requesting casualty forms from Army Human Resources Command using the Freedom of Information Act. It was not an easy process then getting those forms in the spreadsheet. That took some dark magic, ultimately, but we were able to do so and correct any errors in the documents and build a database that allowed us to have these kinds of data insights. Suicide data released publicly by the military, for example, does not include career field tabulations. It does not include unit type tabulations. These kinds of numbers have not been available to the public in a very long time, if at all. And in fact, Congress recently requested a report on suicides broken out by career field. So there's demand for these numbers, and we were fortunate to be in a position where we could build that database ourselves. However, because we built this database ourselves, there's some things that we know we could have done better. For example, the Defense Suicide Prevention Office, citing numbers provided them to the Army, actually is tracking almost more than 30 more suicides than I am for that 3-year period. And without access to their underlying data, which the Army wouldn't provide to me, I can't account for the entire difference between the two. So there's reasons to believe that my database may be a bit of an undercount, which in my assessment makes the findings even more urgent. That if the findings are this dire from a database that might be undercounting Army suicide deaths, wow. It takes my breath away to think about.
What other lessons are there for the Army to take away from all of this?
Something that stood out to me speaking to all of these soldiers was the disconnect between command level messages about these non-combat deployments and the understandings of the soldiers who go on them. Many senior people in the Army remember what the surges were like during the global war on terror, where their units endured similar operational tempo and similar deployment rates. But what these younger soldiers are telling me is that their leaders, who might say, "Suck it up, I had it worse during the surge," could at least tell their families that they were going to fight and do their jobs. Whereas these guys and gals who are going on these non-combat rotations feel like they're being uprooted from their lives for 9 months to just go sit and be cold in Poland, or until 2021 when it switched to strikers there, you know, babysit the demilitarized zone in Korea, or, you know, sit and be a reserve in Kuwait. These soldiers and their families may logically understand the importance of deterrence and reassuring allies, but on a day-to-day basis, it's really hard to reconcile the purpose of the deployments with their experience of the deployments against the impacts that they have on their families back home. Army leaders are putting out their messages about this, and Congress understands them. A lot of people in DC understand them, but I don't know if their soldiers really do. And if I'm an Army senior leader, that's something that I need to address now.
That's it for us this morning. To get more of the top stories and breaking news, go to defensenews.com/EVB to subscribe to the Early Bird Brief newsletter. Please give us a like, rating, and a comment wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media at @defense_news and @MilitaryTimes. The Early Bird Brief is hosted by me, Jonathan Lehrfeld, and produced by Zimon Z. Perez. If you liked our conversation today with Davis, be sure to check out his story at armytimes.com. Our editor-in-chief is Mike Gruss. Have a great day.